Because driving here, it was in Centerfield, is also high in the 90s. It's so hot, and I thought, oh, how will it be in this little sandal? And then, what a great surprise. And it's a little noisy, but then I thought, I don't know, have you ever seen the... I think it's even on YouTube now, from Suzuka Iwashi. It's a small part from the Dharma talk where he explains that in Buddhist practice there is no noise. Yeah. Everything is sound.
Beep, beep. Oh.
And noise is already something, you know, where you have a mental construct to and a judgment. And so he actually suggests that when you hear what you would call immediately noise, just listen to it. Just see it as sound waves. And I actually did this. He will be proud of me doing this last sit. And it's actually quite fascinating. And you really go into the sound, you know, and have no thinking about what it is. It sounds like raindrops. And it's really quite so. I had a lot of joy and gratitude for this machine.
Yes, yes.
So then I'm also, got an email from Joe that he had to go to where? To Chile?
Chile.
So I would have loved to see him in his new robes and new haircut, probably.
Yes, he's keeping it shaved for some time.
Yeah, that's great. So, how is he doing? How is it feeling for him?
He said it was really an incredibly powerful experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll probably be some time before he has any idea what it's about and what that means and so
mm-hmm.
on. But and he said it's already impacting his thoughts and behavior, you know, like the very week after. He was kind of getting into a little towards a tiff with one of his colleagues and just about to kind of become a jerk about it, and then he decided, oh, I can't do that anymore.
Is that true?
Well, you can. That's the problem of it all. But it's a good intention. Yeah, wonderful. That's actually the meaning of the rope, that you keep this kind of present all the time. When you put the rope on, you make yourself aware that you want to become like Chi, like Avalokiteshvara. And I would like to talk a little bit about this theme.
May I interrupt for a minute? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Would it be okay if I turn this down a notch for the recording?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. Do you mind? It'll
you
still be.
You mean my favorite machine?
Yes.
Yes. Too.
It's actually controlled from the other room.
If we start sweltering, then it'll turn
okay.
back up.
Yeah. Thank you.
Maybe
yeah.
you could just move it closer.
Yeah.
No, because it needs to pick up all of us.
Yeah. Well, that should be okay.
We'll keep her
mouth
shut.
But while she's gone, I'll tell you that Joe right now is at a place every day where it's 5 degrees and wind chill of negative 20. So having a bald head where he is now is kind of really, really noticeable.
Wow, is he so high up?
Right.
What's he doing there?
Science. He's
oh,
there for 3 weeks.
Science is chilly. Goodness.
It's one of the driest parts of the world, in the desert in northern Chile. It's really high, and if you want to take climate readings or do observations of the stars, or whatever, it's a perfect place to be.
It's kind of scary to do the reading of climate.
Yeah.
Nowadays,
mm-hmm.
it's so. scary. Also, you know, in Europe, it's so noticeable. They had this amazing cold winter where the East Sea was frozen completely.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unusual. And now they have also an extreme heat wave there. So it's going really more and more into the extremes. It's
there you go, yeah.
Here it's more usual that you are in extremes. Santa Fe, so they have always the cold winters. But in northern Germany, it's not much up and down. And there now it's really changing.
Yeah.
Over the last years.
There was a report the other day that it has been the warmest year so far on record.
Mm. And the winter
in
was...
In the world.
The whole world.
Whole Earth. Mm.
They were sunbathing in Moscow in the park.
Well, you know, they do that.
They take their shirts off when it's 40 degrees.
Yeah, but now they said it was 100 or something. I mean, yeah, really, it was just bizarre.
Oh,
people have never seen anything like it.
Mm. Well, we will have to face some challenges, I guess. I would like to talk a little bit about we haven't been together for quite a while, and I was in, as some of you know, I was as a bearing witness retreat in Auschwitz with my dear friend Natalie Goldberg. But it was a retreat from, and she is Jewish, in case you don't know. And it was a bearing witness retreat organized from Bernie Glassman. And quite a huge group. Peter Matteson was one other teacher, and his wife, and from several countries. We were a group of 160 people, and I don't know, have I talked here before about this, how Natalie and I met? Okay, I give a brief, background to the, you know, I just do it quickly. We once were at the refuge in a retreat in the very 3 years ago or so, when it was just opened, and we tried things out and we went on a hike. And so I took care of Natalie because we were a little back, and then it was a little long for her, and she said, "Oh, how long does this go?" And I said, "I think we are pretty close, but I didn't know so exactly, so I just wanted to cheer her up and went into the opposite at the end. If you say one more time, we are pretty close." So we decided to sit down and had a conversation, and a young Canadian guy was with us, and his parents were from Russia, and Jews. And so for some reason we started a conversation about, he started it actually, and said, you know, how was it for you growing up in Germany after the Second World War? And that was quite a theme in my youth. When I was, I think, around 10, that was then 65. It slowly was brought into the, that's already 20 years after the war, it slowly was brought into the school system. So I had a great history teacher, and he showed the first films released from opening the concentration camp and the liberation and so forth. And that was really a traumatic experience for me, for some reason, and I forgot everything around it. Probably he had prepared us in a certain sense, but for me it felt he didn't have prepared. I just know this unbelievable, horrible movie I saw. And then to integrate this slowly when I'm getting older, to notice, wow, this was the generation of my parents who were the responsible generation in doing the Second World War. And to suddenly to understand more of this kind of where not really was talked about, not just in my family, also, you know, in general. There was not, but you, as a child, you picked up this kind of atmosphere which is around this after the war, and there was a very gloomy atmosphere and what I picked up. So we started talking about, and then Natalie said at a point, Beate, I have to say something. I hate Germans. And that was really a very, very strong statement, a very honest statement also from her. Because I knew already at that time that still many Jews completely avoid being with Germans or visiting Germany. They do often Europe trips but don't go to Germany and so forth. So I was pretty aware of the situation, but still to have it in a personal contact was quite strong for me. Still, it was the very beginning of our friendship. Because if you open up in an honest sense and really say something what you normally wouldn't express, but still you would behave like this, gave us the possibility to really explore this in an open space, to bring that what's there anyway up to the surface, and that it becomes clear. So it was a great chance actually for us to explore that, and we did explore that
right then
several times. Right then, in this we stayed there still for a week together. She did a writing workshops there, so, and we checked in. And then more and more stories came out, and so she was invited, what I didn't knew years ago before, to Germany to teach there. Actually from a friend of mine, who is a filmmaker and a writer and teaching at the University in Munich. And Natalie wrote her back and said, I will never come to Germany. I will never enter German territory. So that she told me, and in this week actually it happened that she opened up more and more because she saw my really deep intrinsic feeling of guilt and shame, where I really, that was so strong in my youth to grow up with that. I often say I traveled a lot when I was young, and I always hated the question when they asked me, where are you from? And there was, I had a strong physical reaction. I really didn't want to tell that I'm German. But there's something, of course you have to live with it, but it was really strong in me, this feeling. For a long time I thought something is kind of wrong with me, and it had to do, you know, the what I had to explore with my father, and just briefly, I don't want to go there, it's not that my father was in any way directly involved in the Holocaust, but as I said, he was the responsible generation at that war. And what made our relationship really difficult was that he was always when I got older, wanted to confront him with it. He often said, it was always this attitude, you don't judge, you don't know how it was at that time, and it's all exaggerated. And it was strong, and it was really, really strong. He didn't deny it, but he said it's all exaggerated. So, and then I could never really talk with him about this. So this was, and that shaped my whole life, or my whole relationship with my father, which was quite distant. I had another experience with my mother, who I dearly loved. So, and then it came up that Bernie Glassman did, again, he had stopped doing this bearing witness retreats in Auschwitz, and then I saw he was doing it again, and it was so clear for me that I had to go there, that I really wanted to go there and to just face it and see what happened, because I felt a deep sense of urgency and necessity to this. So I asked Natalie, and I said, you know, I go to Auschwitz. And she said, immediately, I come with you. Uh-huh. And then she also, and that she already said in this one, after the end of the week, she said, if you come with me to Germany, I will come with you to Germany. And that was a big step for her. It was really a big step. So we actually spent a few days in Berlin together before we went to Auschwitz. And it was quite an experience, a deepening experience for our relationship, but also to understand how conflicts work. And how you really have on a personal level to resolve them. And then Auschwitz is really something, and why I bring it up and talk a lot about it lately. We, Natalie and I, we had several talks, and we really want to explore this more and more. Because it's something which I feel is very important in our Buddhist practice, too. To really understand how we develop a compassionate mind. How we really have to practice this over and over again. To keep ourselves open and in situations free of judgment when we meet people where we normally would have a judgment. That's a big question for me right now, how we can do it. Because when you go to Auschwitz is such an just the place, we spent 5 days there. We were half of the day meditating on the ramp to Birkenau. Birkenau is the death camp directly next to Auschwitz, where the gas chambers were. It's so incomprehensible. It's really, you can only say it's beyond. It's just beyond. Just the place to feel how huge this place is. It's unbelievable when you walk along. And we were sitting on the ramp, which is a huge place where the train came in, where they did the selection immediately. Most had to go to the gas chambers and or to the work camp. So there was immediately the decision about life and death. And it was quite something to sit there. It was very hot when we were there. It was actually quite a heat wave, high in the 90s. So, and we sat in the full sun, which was kind of challenging. But at the same time, I really liked it because it was, it made it so clear also physically to us how intense the place there was, and just, you know, we had water, we had everything. Still. And then we were, one ritual was that we were reading the names of the people who died there, which is only, can only be a small part of the people who died there. 1.5 million people were killed there. This is such an enormous number. You know, it's you can't comprehend, actually. And then really the place starts talking to you, and just by walking it, being in the gas chamber, seeing that they kept some of the hair, a little piece of the part of the hairs, but it's still 2 tons of hair, women hair they have there. It's really so overwhelming to go through there, or, and they have a huge heap behind glass of baby shoes, of children's shoes. So it was, after a while, you get really, it gets completely under your skin. You are completely absorbed by this place, and as more as you understand and feel, and you go into the barracks where the people lived and under which conditions. And Natalie and I, we read a lot, and I thought in my youth I had read a lot about autobiographic reports, and now I really, but to really read it again in the details. Natalie always says in her writing classes, write about details, because God lives in the details. But after that, she also said, you know what? The devil also lives in the details. And that's very true. That's very true. Because when you read, it's not just, an enormous number of people were killed there. And you really feel each of them had a life like us. That's then, and what the brutality and was there, and how disconnected this the Nazis had been from their, you know, humanity, you can say. It's for me still something which I can't bear. I only can bear witness to it. I can't really, really understand it. And then there was a point, does it make sense to go in so many details? And for me, it becomes more and more important, also from my Buddhist practice, to really have a stand in that sense that I kind of made a vow to talk about this more and more, in the sense of bearing witness and really to name it. And there's a little book from Alice Walker, which just a friend gave to me, and it's called Overcoming Speechlessness. And I think that's a brilliant title for my inner feeling. This, you become completely speechless there at Auschwitz. It's just... And first you have the experience by reading more and more details. Normally it functions that you get informed, and then when you are informed and have some knowledge, you understand better. You know more, so you understand. But my process was absolutely the opposite. We were reading and reading more, but it became more and more, we can't understand, you can't grasp it. It's quite something. So overcoming speechlessness is really important also nowadays to really have a stand and talk, and don't forget not just Auschwitz, also not forget half of our planet, where still horrible, horrible atrocities are happening. And I feel it more and more, and of course it's the engaged Buddhism where also Upaya stands for, and especially Bernie Glassman stands for. But I feel it's just a call really for humanity, that we have to be witness. When we don't witness it or don't speak about it, we become kind of, it's another form of guilt we enter, because silence only always helps the oppressor, never the victim. So it's important for me, and I feel a real urgency to this, and I hope I don't overload you with it, because it's just so much in my present field, and I'm still integrating, and the whole group is still integrating, because it, what also happened, and that's, I would call the miracle of these places and the wisdom of Bernie, how he just brings the group there, and we were 160 people, so really men from all over the world, mainly Jews, some German, but also from Palestinian, some people. So by listening to each other's stories, there was a process happening in the group, which was quite amazing, of a deep feeling of connectedness, which turned over the days into also a deep form of gratitude, a deep form of joy. And it's really hard to tell about that, but nearly everybody had this experience too. We had joyous feelings in Auschwitz. And I know we have to be careful to call that joyous. But what was the joy? We did many ceremonies. There was a wonderful, wonderful rabbi who could beautifully sing and playing the guitar, and then sometimes the second person. And we did Kaddish to really deeply remember the many, many people who died there. And in this remembrance, it was always a point for him. We also have to turn towards life. We have to be joyful. We have to be alive. We have deeply to feel our aliveness. When this is not there, then it's... And we have, he even called it, we have to do it especially for them too, mm-hmm. that they see in a symbolic way how life continues, and that we can remember them and come together in a new formation as Jews and German. That's also a real transformative act, a real form of healing. Because there was still, I mean, there was a wonderful person from New York who said, I was born in New York, I never was in Europe, but it was just taught among the Jews that, you know, she said, I cringed when I just heard German talking. That was, it was just my, I couldn't handle it. And there she was among all the Germans, and there were so many laughter, so many tears, so many really being together. You were just joyful. Who, it didn't matter who was next to you. You know, the mind where we hear are often in, who is this person? Do I like this about this person? Oh, what did she say there? You don't care in this situation. It's kind of you drop into a deeper place of open possibilities. It's just this pure plane of open possibilities. And you feel just blessed that this beautiful person is next to you. No matter who he is or what. In face, when you face these atrocities, it's everything is quite okay, or everything vanishes. Also, from my little, what I talked in the beginning about, and you know, it was really there. I had a lot of feeling of shame and guilt, and my youth was kind of complicated, and I really wanted to make a difference. I think one of the streams even is that I came from there, that I decided to become a Buddhist. But being there, there was a voice in me which said, come on, Beate, forget about all your little pity, little tiny pity. I mean, it's just so incomprehensible what people went through there, and what is possible that people went through there. Mm-hmm. And people survived, a few survived that. And made it. I mean, it's another friend told me, and I think that's really interesting. I don't know if you know Elie Wiesel. He's quite famous here in the US. I know he wrote the book Night, which is often read here at school. And a friend of mine was involved as a counselor after the Columbine massacre at the school, you remember. And there were many of these kids who survived. They were so traumatized that quite a few of them were highly suicidal. Mm. So they did therapy and counseling, but that was already quite a while later, and nothing really worked. So, and I don't know how it came together, but one brought in Elie Wiesel, and he did a whole day with them. And I don't even know exactly what he did, but probably he talked about, because he was, at their age, he was in Auschwitz for 3 or 4 years. It's quite amazing that he survived so long. And my feel, it's just an interpretation. The fact is, which my friend knew, that after this day, the world had changed for these kids. They probably, they got a feeling of, first of all, there's someone who really understands trauma, what they feel, where they went through. And then they probably saw, this is someone who lived on a daily basis through that, what we had for a few hours. And then there's something in the mind which can really then let go, or say, it's okay. And that was, in a certain sense, also my experience in Auschwitz, that I could let go also this old kind of unresolved situation. I wouldn't really call it unresolved, but situation with my father. I never came close with my father when my father died. I didn't shed a tear. It was not that we were still quite a functioning family, and I saw him often, so we didn't just split up or separated. But there was no really, I just couldn't forgive him that he didn't acknowledge his guilt. So what happened in Auschwitz is, and that was quite amazing for me, because I never thought that something comes up like this. There was also a ceremony for the perpetrators, and I really could connect in this ceremony because the field was so open and, you know, you were so worked through to these days. I really could feel also my father in it and could forgive him, because there are, as for every perpetrator, there, and that's, don't misunderstand me, I don't mean it in the sense as an apology or to excuse him, it's okay, but every person has a story which leads to certain circumstances. So this was also quite amazing. And the last ceremony we did there was, there's a pond. And now we were there in the summer, it really looks beautiful. There's an old alley with old trees, and then this beautiful pond. And another friend, before I went, she sent me an email, and I will never forget this sentence. It was just a side sentence. And she said, I wish you all the best, and when you are there, don't forget there was not a single blade of grass, because it was all eaten. Mm. So they all, there was just bare earth. And when you see it, it's huge. And everything is green there, because it's, you know, it grows like crazy. It's raining and sunny. So now it's very green. And I had, for all this day, I always had this sentence in my mind. Sometimes the prisoners, another Jewish friend wrote me that, were too weak to just get the grass up. So they ate like cows, just with their mouths, and they could find something. So now there was this beautiful pond. And the story of the pond, they have a memorial site there, and we had ritual candles, many Jewish people with names, very beautiful candles, and they put them there in a ceremony. And in this pond, they shuffled all the ash and pieces of bones from the crematorium, from all the people they burned there. And to stay there in front, and to really with the knowledge that there is the ashes of thousands of thousands, maybe a million people in this pond, is kind of really overwhelming. And then it happened that Natalie had, you know, friends had said, she had so many candles that she just then said, "Here, Beata, take this two candles and put them there with me." So we went, and this was an amazing moment for me, really, to have these candles for Jewish people to remember, and to for me at, that I got kind of permission, maybe that's not, but I felt like I got permission to put these candles there. Was really amazing for me, and kind of really deep healing. And we first sang a song there. There were many frogs in this pond, and it was kind of noisy. And then we sang a song, and of course the frogs were silent. and then we stopped and were doing the ceremony, and suddenly all the frogs were.
Really?
It was amazing. And everybody, and I mean, of course, we are completely in the ceremony field, but everybody had the feeling, wow, they are answering us. They are talking to us. It was quite something. And then I read also the, I don't have the time, please stop me.
7:56.
Oh, we should
stop. 7:50.
I have a question.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
My uncle told me when he was there with Bernie Klassman, the rabbi told a beautiful story of a woman in one of the concentration camps who became like a leader because of her spirituality. And she went to the gas chamber singing, praising God.
Well,
I was wondering if the rabbi there spoke about her, because I've heard about her after that too.
I didn't hear this specific story, but it's very present there in all. And I finish in a second what also Viktor Frankl in his book The Search for Meaning brought up, that the people who had a spiritual vision, or that could be God, that could be any, that could be a beloved one, for where there was the reason to live for, or it could be they were not willing to completely lose their humanity in this really outrageous circumstances, they were the one who mainly survived. Not the physically most robust people, that's at least is his observation. And he says, it's so important that we have this deep search of meaning in our life. And then he said, we can find it mainly in three parts: in our work, that we really do significant work, in our love, or in a compassionate field to each other, or in really developing courage in difficult circumstances. And there, and then Joseph Campbell once said, it's not so much the meaning we search for, we search for aliveness. And this is very close connected, to have this kind of deep spiritual search or looking for meaning is always combined with a certain kind of aliveness, and that's important for our practice here nowadays, beside what happened there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Post-talk,
or do they get the voice over?
Mm.
Do people remember how to say it?
You can fake it.
Okay. Yeah,
and it's a special.
What did you say?
Fake it till you make it.
May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
May I ask who of you has a Jewish background?
Well, German and Jewish. My father's Jewish, my mother's German.
Wow. Yeah, there's a whole other complication in this.
My grandmother is German, and we don't know who she really was, and think there's a possibility that she was Jewish. Nobody knows.
I'm German. Joe's Jewish. My grandmother, I heard, was sent out of Germany as a young woman because her family was afraid she would be killed because she was actively opposing the Nazis. And my aunt didn't know and only found out recently in her 50s that she's half Jewish.
My father and his family fled Warsaw when he was 7, and he has narrated this amazing story of his journey to the United States, when his recollections when he was a child, and he got here when he was 8, through a very convoluted travel plan, because borders kept shifting, and they were going into Lithuania, which was not Lithuania at some point, and back and forth, and finally went from Russia to Japan to San Francisco, and then to New York. And I love reading that memoir. He's still living, but it's just his voice is so present in it, and from a he admits from a child's perspective, a lot of times it was very adventuresome. And he spoke 2 or 3 languages. He was often the interpreter for the family. It was just it's just wonderful. So it is totally part of my history, my personal history. And I know that one of his cousins, who was a doctor, was in a concentration camp, survived. And I was always just fascinated by that concept. I mean, she was so much older than I was when I was growing up, but I know she had a tattoo, and it just, the whole reality of that was so amazing, and the majority of my dad's family basically vanished, evaporated, and tells which uncle decided to stay, and which one left, and some who went to Canada. It was just really, it's an amazing story. Very, very precious.
Yeah, the Polish people had really the most to carry. I mean, 3 million Jews were Polish, who were killed. So there was, we had a Polish guide the first day, and she said, just to make numbers for you more clear, is what happened at 9/11 happened to just the Polish people. The same amount of dead people, the same amount of terror and horror every day for 5 years.
Jeez.
This is so, can you imagine? You have this 9/11 and then the next
mm-hmm.
day and then
mm-hmm.
the next day and then the next day. It's
little snacks and cookies and iced tea next door.
Oh, you are such a wonderful host.
Yes.
Iced tea, how nice.